Chapter 11. From the water, sheltered from the sun by a couple of coconut leaves. No one but Otu could have dragged me there and stuck up the leaves for shade. He was lying beside me. I went off again, and the next time I came round, it was cool and starry night, and Otu was pressing a drinking coconut to my lips. We were the sole survivors of the Petit John. Captain Outhouse must have succumbed to exhaustion, for several days later his hatch cover drifted ashore without him. Otu and I lived with the natives of the atoll for a week, when we were rescued by the French cruiser and taken to Tahiti. In the meantime, however, we had performed the ceremony of exchanging names. In the South Sea, such a ceremony binds two men closer together than blood brothership. The initiative had been mine, and Otu was rapturously delighted when I suggested it. "It is well," he said, "in Tahitian. Effer, we have been mates together for 2 days on the lips of death." But death stuttered. I smiled. "It was a brave deed you did, master," he replied, "and death was not vile enough to speak." "Why do you master me?" I demanded, with a show of hurt feelings. "We have exchanged names. To you I am Otu. To me you are Charlie. And between you and me, forever and forever, you shall be Charlie, and I shall be Otu. It is the way of the custom. And when we die, if it does happen, that we live again somewhere beyond the stars and the sky, still shall you be Charlie to me, and I Otu to you." "Yes, master," he answered, his eyes luminous and soft with joy. "There you go," I cried indignantly. "What does it matter what my lips utter?" he argued. "They are only my lips. But I shall think Otu always. Whenever I think of myself, I shall think of you. Whenever men call me by name, I shall think of you. And beyond the sky, and beyond the stars, always and forever, you shall be Otu to me. Is it well, master?" I hid my smile, and answered that it was well. We parted at Papeete. I remained ashore to recuperate, and he went on in a cutter to his own island, Bora Bora. 6 weeks later he was back. I was surprised, for he had told me of his wife, and said that he was returning to her, and would give over sailing on far voyages. "Where do you go, master?" he asked, after our first greetings. I shrugged my shoulders. It was a hard question. "All the world," was my answer. "LL the world, all the sea, and all the islands that are in the sea." "I will go with you," he said simply. "M my wife is dead. I never had a brother, but from what I have seen of other men's brothers, I doubt if any man ever had a brother that was to him what Otu was to me. He was brother and father and mother as well. And this I know. I lived as traitor and better man because of Otu. I cared little for other men, but I had to live straight in Otu's eyes. Because of him, I dared not tarnish myself. He made me his ideal, compounding me, I fear, chiefly out of his own love and worship, and there were times when I stood close to the steep pitch of hell and would have taken the plunge had not the thought of Otu restrained me. His pride in me entered into me, until it became one of the major rules in my personal code to do nothing that would diminish that pride of his. Naturally, I did not learn right away what his feelings were toward me. He never criticized, never censured, and slowly the exalted place I held in his eyes dawned upon me, and slowly I grew to comprehend the hurt I could inflict upon him by being anything less than my best. For 17 years we were together. For 17 years he was at my shoulder, watching while I slept, nursing me through fever and wounds, and receiving wounds in fighting for me. He signed on the same ships with me, and together we ranged the Pacific from Hawaii to Sydney Head, and from Torres Straits to the Galapagos. We blackbirded from the New Hebrides and the Line Islands over to the westward, clear through the Louisades, New Britain, New Ireland, and New Hanover. We were wrecked 3 times in the Gilberts, in the Santa Cruz group, and in the Fidjis. And we traded and salved wherever a dollar promised in the way of pearl and pearl shell, copra, betch de mer, hawkbill turtle shell, and stranded wrecks. It began in Papeete, immediately after his announcement, that he was going with me over all the sea, and the islands in the midst thereof. There was a club in those days in Papeete, where the pearlers, traders, captains, and riffraff of South Sea adventurers foregathered. The play ran high, and the drink ran high, and I am very much afraid that I kept later hours than were becoming or proper. No matter what the hour was when I left the club, there was O2 waiting to see me safely home. At first I smiled, next I chided him. Then I told him flatly that I stood in need of no wet nursing. After that I did not see him when I came out of the club. Quite by accident, a week or so later, I discovered that he still saw me home, lurking across the street among the shadows of the mango trees. What could I do? I know what I did do. Insensibly I began to keep better hours. On wet and stormy nights, in the thick of the folly and the fun, the thought would persist in coming to me of O2 keeping his dreary vigil under the dripping mangoes. Truly, he made a better man of me. Yet he was not straight-laced. And he knew nothing of common Christian morality. All the people on Bora Bora were Christians. But he was a heathen, the only unbeliever on the island, a gross materialist, who believed that when he died he was dead. He believed merely in fair play and square dealing. Petty meanness, in his code, was almost as serious as wanton homicide. And I do believe that he respected a murderer more than a man given to small practices. Concerning me, personally, he objected to my doing anything that was hurtful to me. Gambling was all right. He was an ardent gambler himself. But late hours, he explained, were bad for one's health. He had seen men who did not take care of themselves die of fever. He was no teetotaler, and welcomed a stiff nip any time when it was wet work in the boats. On the other hand, he believed in liquor in moderation. He had seen many men killed or disgraced by square face or scotch. O2 had my welfare always at heart. He thought ahead for me, weighed my plans, and took a greater interest in them than I did myself. At first, when I was unaware of this interest of his in my affairs, he had to divine my intentions, as, for instance, at Papeete, when I contemplated going partners with a knavish fellow countryman on a guano venture. I did not know he was a knave, nor did any white man in Papeete. Neither did O2 know, but he saw how thick we were getting, and found out for me, and without my asking him. Native sailors from the ends of the seas knock about on the beach in Tahiti, and O2, suspicious merely, went among them till he had gathered sufficient data to justify his suspicions. Oh, it was a nice history, that of Randolph Waters. I couldn't believe it when O2 first narrated it, but when I sheeted it home to Waters he gave in without a murmur, and got away on the first steamer to Auckland. At first, I am free to confess, I couldn't help resenting O2's poking his nose into my business. But I knew that he was wholly unselfish, and soon I had to acknowledge his wisdom and discretion. He had his eyes open always to my main chance, and he was both keen-sighted and far-sighted. In time he became my counselor, until he knew more of my business than I did myself. He really had my interest at heart more than I did. Mine was the magnificent carelessness of youth, for I preferred romance to dollars, and adventure to a comfortable billet with all night in. So it was well that I had someone to look out for me. I know that, if it had not been for O2, I should not be here today. Of numerous instances, let me give one. I had had some experience in blackbirding before I went pearling in the Palmetas. O2 and I were on the beach in Samoa. We really were on the beach and hard aground when my chance came to go as recruiter on a blackbird brig. O2 signed on before the mast, and for the next half dozen years, in as many ships, we knocked about the wildest portions of Melanesia. O2 saw to it that he always pulled stroke oar in my boat. Our custom in recruiting labor was to land the recruiter on the beach. The covering boat always lay on its oars several hundred feet offshore, while the recruiter's boat, also lying on its oars, kept afloat on the edge of the beach. When I landed with my trade goods, leaving my steering sweep apeak, O2 left his stroke position and came into the stern sheets, where a Winchester lay ready to hand under a flap of canvas. The boat's crew was also armed, the Sniders concealed under canvas flaps that ran the length of the gunwales. While I was busy arguing and persuading the woolly-headed cannibals to come and labor on the Queensland plantations, O2 kept watch. And often his low voice warned me of suspicious actions and impending treachery. Sometimes it was the quick shot from his rifle, knocking a nigger over, that was the first warning I received. And in my rush to the boat as H, and was always there to jerk me flying aboard. Once, I remember, on Santa Ana, the boat grounded just as the trouble began. The covering boat was dashing to our assistance, but the several score of savages would have wiped us out before it arrived. O2 took a flying leap ashore, dug both hands into the trade goods, and scattered tobacco, beads, tomahawks, knives, and calicoes in all directions. This was too much for the woolly heads. While they scrambled for the treasures, the boat was shoved clear, and we were aboard and 40 feet away. And I got 30 recruits off that very beach in the next 4 hours. The particular instance I have in mind was on Malaita, the most savage island in the easterly Solomons. The natives had been remarkably friendly, and how were we to know that the whole village had been taking up a collection for over 2 years with which to buy a white man's head? The beggars are all headhunters, and they especially esteem a white man's head. The fellow who captured the head would receive the whole collection. As I say, they appeared very friendly, and on this day I was fully 100 yards down the beach from the boat. O2 had cautioned me, and, as usual when I did not heed him, I came to grief. The first I knew, a cloud of spears sailed out of the mangrove swamp at me. At least a dozen were sticking into me. I started to run, but tripped over one that was fast in my calf, and went down. The woolly heads made a run for me, each with a long-handled, fantail tomahawk with which to hack off my head. They were so eager for the prize that they got in one another's way. In the confusion, I avoided several hacks by throwing myself right and left on the sand. Then O2 arrived, O2 the manhandler. In some way he had got hold of a heavy war club, and at close quarters it was a far more efficient weapon than a rifle. He was right in the thick of them, so that they could not spear him, while their tomahawks seemed worse than useless. He was fighting for me, and he was in a true berserker rage. The way he handled that club was amazing. Their skulls squashed like overripe oranges. It was not until he had driven them back, picked me up in his arms, and started to run, that he received his first wounds. He arrived in the boat with 4 spear thrusts, got his Winchester, and with it got a man for every shot. Then we pulled aboard the schooner, and doctored up. 17 years we were together. He made me. I should today be a supercargo, a recruiter, or a memory, if it had not been for him. You spend your money, and you go out and get more, he said one day. It is easy to get money now. But when you get old, your money will be spent, and you will not be able to go out and get more. I know, master. I have studied the way of white men. On the beaches are many old men who were young once, and who could get money just like you. Now they are old, and they have nothing, and they wait about for the young men like you to come ashore and buy drinks for them. The black boy is a slave on the plantations. He gets $20 a year. He works hard. The overseer does not work hard. He rides a horse and watches the black boy work. He gets $1,200 a year. I am a sailor on the schooner. I get $15 a month. That is because I am a good sailor. I work hard. The captain has a double awning and drinks beer out of long bottles. I have never seen him haul a rope or pull an oar. He gets $150 a month. I am a sailor. He is a navigator. Master, I think it would be very good for you to know navigation. O2 spurred me onto it. He sailed with me as second mate on my first schooner, and he was far prouder of my command than I was myself. Later on it was, "The captain is well paid, master, but the ship is in his keeping, and he is never free from the burden. It is the owner who is better paid, the owner who sits ashore with many servants and turns his money over." "True, but a schooner costs $5,000, an old schooner at that," I objected. I should be an old man before I saved $5,000. "There be short ways for white men to make money," he went on, pointing ashore at the coconut-fringed beach. We were in the Solomons at the time, picking up a cargo of ivory nuts along the east coast of Guadalcanal. "Between this river mouth and the next it is 2 miles, he said. "The flat land runs far back. It is worth nothing now. Next year, who knows? Or the year after, men will pay much money for that land. The anchorage is good. Big steamers can lie close up. You can buy the land 4 miles deep from the old chief for 10,000 sticks of tobacco, 10 bottles of square face, and a Snyder, which will cost you, maybe, $100. Then you place the deed with the commissioner, and the next year, or the year after, you sell and become the owner of a ship." I followed his lead, and his words came true, though in 3 years, instead of 2. Next came the grasslands deal on Guadalcanal, 20,000 acres, on a governmental 999 years lease at a nominal sum. I owned the lease for precisely 90 days, when I sold it to a company for half a fortune. Always it was O2 who looked ahead, and saw the opportunity. He was responsible for the salving of the Doncaster bought in at auction for £100, and clearing £3,000 after every expense was paid. He led me into the Savai plantation, and the cocoa venture on Abalu. We did not go seafaring, so much as in the old days. I was too well off. I married, and my standard of living rose. But O2 remained the same old-time O2, moving about the house or trailing through the office, his wooden pipe in his mouth, a shilling undershirt on his back, and a 4-shilling lava-lava about his loins. I could not get him to spend money. There was no way of repaying him except with love, and God knows he got that in full measure from all of us. The children worshipped him, and if he had been spoilable, my wife would surely have been his undoing. The children. He really was the one who showed them the way of their feet in the world practical. He began by teaching them to walk. He sat up with them when they were sick. One by one, when they were scarcely toddlers, he took them down to the lagoon and made them into amphibians. He taught them more than I ever knew of the habits of fish and the ways of catching them. In the bush it was the same thing. At 7, Tom knew more woodcraft than I ever dreamed existed. At 6, Mary went over the sliding rock without a quiver, and I have seen strong men balk at that feat. And when Frank had just turned 6, he could bring up shillings from the bottom in 3 fathoms. My people in Bora Bora do not like heathen, they are all Christians. And I do not like Bora Bora Christians, he said one day, when I, with the idea of getting him to spend some of the money that was rightfully his, had been trying to persuade him to make a visit to his own island in one of our schooners, a special voyage which I had hoped to make a record breaker in the matter of prodigal expense. I say one of our schooners, though legally at the time they belonged to me. I struggled long with him to enter into partnership. We have been partners from the day the Petit John went down, he said at last. Be but if your heart so wishes, then shall we become partners by the law. I have no work to do, yet are my expenses large. I drink and eat and smoke in plenty, it costs much, I know. I do not pay for the playing of billiards, for I play on your table, but still the money goes. Fishing on the reef is only a rich man's pleasure. It is shocking, the cost of hooks and cotton line. Yes, it is necessary that we be partners by the law. I need the money. I shall get it from the head clerk in the office. So the papers were made out and recorded. A year later I was compelled to complain. Charlie, said I, you are a wicked old fraud, a miserly skinflint, a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.